This is Retrobix After Hours.
Oh, hi. Welcome, hello, and other words of greeting. It's Rack Addicts After Hours time again. This is a music and technology podcast. I'm Ben. Pete is here. And it's episode 197, can you believe it? We'll do exactly the same thing as every week, because repetition is the key to doors. Pete, what have you been doing this week?
Well, I have received the Cannondale mountain bike back from the Kona specialists, and it's in really good order. They managed to do everything and more.
I think it looks the business.
Yes.
It's fresh as you like.
You saw it gracing the hall.
Oh, I did. Wonderful.
Unfortunately, well, it's not unfortunate per se, but they wheeled it out to me, explained what I did, and then said, you can't ride it, it's too valuable.
Did they actually?
Well, they basically said it's of an age and of a rarity that you should seriously consider not riding it.
Oh my. Ooh, here we go. So, I sent a picture to our friend Ant, who happens to have run a bike shop in his past. And I sent a picture and he said, Christ alive! And followed it up with, I'm surprised it's not snapped in half like most of the others. yeah, anyway, as you were.
Yes, the guy who did the servicing on it said their nickname for Cannondale was Crack and Fail.
Oh yeah, there we go. That explains it all.
So they do have a reputation of, because they're an aluminium frame, they do have a reputation of splitting. And in fact, he pointed out to a safety warning sticker that I had not read on frame saying, look out for cracks.
Right.
So there is a bit of a thing that they have.
But in fresh condition like that one, have you had a look at the old the prices you might be able to scoop for it.
He reckons that I could get between 500 and 600 for it.
I thought you were going to say 5,000 and 6,000.
No, not quite that. But he said if you were able to just keep it as it is and put it away for another 25 years, it would be worth a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah, how old is it?
1999. That's how old it is.
Certainly a good price for a mountain bike of that vintage.
Yes, and I have been perusing the website that we mentioned last week. The Retro Bikes. .co.uk and there are several versions of it, let's say, and people generally are selling the frame on its own for about 200.
Not bad.
I was told I could get £50 each for the wheels because they haven't been braked on.
Yeah, fresh braking tracks there.
Yeah, there's no braking tracks because it's got discs. So the regular V700s had centerpoles and coil shocks and various other downgraded bits, whereas that one's got the hydraulic disc brakes. Yeah. And the air shocks on it.
It's what you want.
But it was a strange time, I've been told, for mountain biking. It was when they were crossing over from being...
Yeah, and the shapes were getting wild.
Yes, because they kind of got a bit more conventional.
They've settled down into a pretty stable sort of shape at the moment.
And is it cold-formed? That's what the terminology says, isn't it? They're cold-formed steel, so that's why they have these triangular type of frames nowadays. When I say triangular, the actual tubing's triangular, or... It's sort of box section, but angled.
Not so much. If it's steel, it's likely to be mostly round. And the aluminium ones, I think they hydroform it these days. So it could be any number of weird profiles. It could be kind of more of a D shape from round. It could have quite sharp corners like a more triangular thing, but they can do all sorts with it. And obviously carbon fiber ones will be all sorts of weird shapes.
Yes. The only thing that worries me about carbon fiber is it's easily cracked. You know, it's got this sort of tensile strength, but you can pierce it.
Once you ding it, it's weakened significantly.
So I am going to steer away from carbon fiber.
Yeah.
But I have a hankering and I have the cash at hand, and I'm thinking that I might grab one of these Konas. I don't know why, even though the Cannondale's shiny and ready to hit the road and it's running, or it's in a better condition than it has been ever, to be honest.
Yeah.
The way they've set up the derailleurs and everything else, I'm minded not to ride it.
Don't know why. Conundrum there.
Yes, it is. It's strange that I feel more comfortable getting a really nice shiny new bike and throwing it about and getting it all muddy and horrible and riding it all over the place, and not the Cannondale.
Unfortunately, it's achieved the museum piece category, potentially.
Yes. So I'm going to have to dust off the Holdsworthy, which is
oh yeah
the loft, because as I said last week, that's 40 years old.
Mm.
And I believe that that might be quite valuable in itself as well.
An attic find.
Yes.
Although, of course, you knew it was there.
Yes, it's not exactly lost. It's just hiding up there. This is the trouble. You do things to them, you modify them and realise, because when people collect things, I knew about this with motorcycles.
Yeah.
Several of the motorcycles I had in the late 70s and early 80s are now really collectible.
Mm.
At the time, you wouldn't imagine. But you could also translate that to synthesizers I had in the 80s that
at
are now really
collectible.
At the time,
you can never tell if it's going to be a classic.
No, you have no idea. You use it and abuse it and think nothing of it. And then X amount of decades later, you go, oh, damn, why didn't I look after it and keep it?
Should have treated it better.
Yes, exactly. So I just put that down to experience, I suppose. Some people seem to have an innate understanding of what's going to become a classic in whatever genre they're working in.
You've probably just got to have been at it for a long time.
I suppose so, but my mind doesn't normally think in those terms. I mean, various objects are there to be utilised and enjoyed at the time. You don't think, oh, I better slip this into my bottom drawer and leave it there for 40 years.
Yeah, and I've definitely gone on record many times saying I enjoy the way things age, so I want them to age faster.
Yes. But the point being, it's even the bikes that I've hardly done anything, the thing they pointed out is it's a shame it hasn't got the original tyres on it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I threw those away because I didn't think about that. They'd been deflated, they were perished, they were old.
Yeah, dry, rotted or whatever.
But apparently that would have enhanced its value.
Weird.
It's all about originality.
Yeah.
But it makes sense because you see it all along. You know, motorcycles are more valuable if they're completely original.
Yeah.
You know, you even see that in not so classic motorcycles where people get one, original one, and then they modify it with proper, genuine components that are either third party but are, you know, high quality or even from the manufacturer, and it devalues the product.
Yeah.
So there you go. Don't change your tyres.
Ride them until they're bald and then sell it.
Yes.
But they're original.
Other than that, my Osmos is ready for collection.
Whoa, I wasn't expecting that this week.
Yeah, neither was I.
I can't remember if we said it on the podcast or not, but you'd kind of, you know, it had been so long, you'd gone a bit cold on it.
I might still be cold on it, to be honest. I have
mixed
the
feelings about paying the remainder.
Yes.
Ah.
Exactly that.
Mm.
I'm thinking to myself, do I really want this now I'm hearing all these rumours about problems?
Yeah.
It's an expensive thing to find out that it's got issues.
Mm. What's the damage?
I've got another 1,200 to pay.
Have any been back through the shop for repair?
Not that I'm aware of, but I haven't really dug in deep.
Yeah.
And it's only just this week that we've got the first major batch of them coming in, because they've been delayed and delayed and delayed. So we're really going to start. I might just keep it sort of on the back burner and make a decision. Just say, I'm going to leave it where it is. I'll sort it out.
Wait as long as you can.
Yeah, I might wait out and see if we suddenly see loads of them coming back because there's all sorts of niggly issues.
Yeah, or a firmware update fixes everything or something. Or is it mechanical?
I suspect that potentially they could be subject to mechanical issues, if anything, really.
It is a complex action, that one.
Yeah, I'm not really worried about the actual synth engine itself. It's pretty...
It's just code.
Yeah, it's just... and it's established as well. So we'll see. But I've gone off the boil.
Well, it is only to be expected for 4 years of waiting.
Yes, we'll see, we'll see. Mm. What I have got excited about is that I'm going to order myself a Starlab, a Strymon Starlab. It's effectively the
Eurorack.
Yes.
Yeah, we were talking about it last week, because didn't Mark get one?
Mark
had one anyway.
Mark's got one, but I suddenly discovered they do black ones.
Oh my, how dangerous for
yes,
the Scarabs.
Exactly. So I've already made the arrangements so that I can order one.
Of course you have.
But I did a little bit of research and I spoke to Mark and said, what do you think? And he said, they're phenomenal. But I've got...
You've got a Big Sky and a Timeline.
And a Night Sky.
Do you have the Mobius as well?
No.
Not as applicable, but yeah.
I was thinking about getting the Volante though, which is the tape
the
Echo.
Green one, isn't it? It's quite big green, yeah.
But no, I can see myself ending up with both of the Eurorack modules.
I did enjoy the Magneto when I borrowed it when I first started at the shop.
And they haven't got any cheaper.
Really?
No.
It is a weird looking module on the back because it's got something like 4 or 5 PCBs on there.
There's a lot going on.
Yes, yeah, so you know, the two rows of jacks on each side, those that have their own PCBs. There's obviously one for panel components. Then there's like one that's probably the main board. And then there's weirdly shaped other ones on the back. It's a mess.
Yes.
So it's deep, but you've got loads of space in your Scarabs.
Yeah, and I suspect that they're identical hardware on both of them.
Could possibly be.
And I think it's just the algorithm that's running in there that makes them different, and front panel colour.
Yeah. They do have cool jacks though. If you look at them from the side, side, they have a clear panel and you can see the little spring that holds a jack in, which is satisfying and unnecessary, but I like it.
Yes, no. But yeah, as soon as I saw there was a black one to be had, I thought, oh dear, I'm going to have to get one. So that will go into Scarab number 3.
They are power hungry, so check you've got the beans.
Yes, yes, they definitely are. You had a right issue, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I had this at the time. It was two rows of 104 HP, which was 60% full, maybe. Then I added in the Magneto, that's what it's called. I added in the Magneto, and the poor little Micro Zeus could not keep up.
No, it wouldn't be up to it, unless you had the larger power blocks for it.
I did.
You had the biggest one they do.
And I moved the jumper that disables the +5 volts because I didn't need it. And yeah, I took a few out that I wasn't using and it was fine, but you it couldn't there. Do everything at once.
You got there eventually.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine something like that really being quite a power hog.
Yeah, it was quite amusing because it was a small case and then I had that and the Bafaco Hex Mix, just the main mix a bit, not the expander. And that was like a third of the case just for those two modules.
So what was your general opinion about the Magneto, was it?
It was really nice. The quality of the kind of tape emulation-y, tape artifact-y effect stuff, yeah, it felt right. It was good. At the time, I had no strong opinions on how I liked my delay, but it was clear that it was really capable. And I also wasn't, I had used loopers before, but I wasn't into loopers, but having the looper capability on there, and it was quite easy to use, I think was pretty cool, especially if you've got a keyboard connected and you're playing stuff. That was really nice to have.
Great. As I said earlier, I can see myself ending up with both the units, but I'm not sure how I'm going to power them.
Yeah, might need to beef it up a smidge. Or put them in separate scarabs and you might be all right.
Yeah, that might be the way, but you kind of think you want them both together to be sort of delaying and then reverbing.
Of course.
But the thought of having effectively a night sky in modular... It's quite alluring. Anyway,
good stuff.
That's pretty much my week.
Mine has actually had things happen in it for a change. That's weird. Firstly, I built my disintegrated crackle box, which is one of the kits that it was the kit that we did at Test Chamber Live in the airplane shed. And I wasn't involved as a punter, but I grabbed a kit to do at home at some point. It's a really, really easy one, just all through hole and stuff. And it's this little bit bigger than credit card size touch plate kind of noise box. And the only problem was that my Maplin Special, may they rest in peace, soldering station has not quite kicked the bucket, but it has gone wrong in a way that makes it a little bit unusable. It doesn't have temperature control anymore. It just maxes out as soon as you turn it on. So I have a few bits of burnt flux on that PCB.
You need to invest in a decent Weller soldering iron.
I didn't, but I did get a replacement.
Okay.
And this was something I saw on Tested a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And I can't remember what it's called because it's an open source project. So it's just called like the TS-101, which sounds very synthy. I sent Gareth a picture of this because I was very excited. But it is that USB soldering iron,
okay,
which goes up to about 400 degrees,
which
if you want it to.
Reasonably hot.
Yeah, very, very small tip. I think if you're doing anything like a UK mains plug, it probably won't have the beans to do it very well. But for surface mount stuff, little tiny through-hole bits, I think it'll be great.
What was the damage on that?
It was, with a Black Friday deal and the package up that comes with a beefy, fast-charging USB thingy-majig, £60.
It's not so bad.
It's not too bad, not too bad.
Is it plugged in all the time when you're using it?
Yes, doesn't have an internal battery or anything.
So it's just taking that 5 volts and using that to heat the element?
Yeah, I don't know how it does it, but it's wild. It does make a strange noise.
Oh dear.
Yeah, but it's not a loud one, it's just a subtle thing. But yeah, it seems good. I'll have to wait for whatever other soldering thing I have to do at some point to give you the full beans, but just messing around with tinning it and some bits of breadboard component and such went well.
Oh, excellent.
But further to the crackle box story... It's going to be one of those ones that I struggle to articulate the full gamut of things that occurred. So, my partner knows that I do strange synthy stuffs, but she doesn't really, you know, understand synthy things because it's not her vibe. But I sort of said, hey, look, I made the thing that we did at Test Chamber, and she had a go and had an absolute laugh. She loved it, making these. Actually, it's very loud. It's got a little tiny speaker on it, and in a small room, it does kind of hurt your ears a bit, but it makes crazy noises. And she was having an absolute blast, and it was awesome. Really cool moment. And then it made me think of all those other awesome instruments like the Soma Lyra 8 and the Bastel Castle, and I was filled with all these thoughts of how awesome it is that people who don't necessarily know much about experimental music yet can get so much satisfaction out of really responsive tactile instruments. And I just want to show more people cool instruments like that. And that, yeah, that's what I was thinking. But it just made me very happy. It was a cool time.
A cool experience.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what other instruments there are like that. I guess there's the new Soma, is it Enna?
Is that the one that is a piece of wood,
yeah,
like a slice from a tree trunk?
Yeah, and it's got the golden studs, I think you press, that kind of thing. But there's also, I was really inspired by Alan's first thing that he did at the ModCaf when he was talking about the Benjulin and how he found it super inspiring. He'd taken piano lessons ages ago and never really got into it, but he always loved music. And then he connected with this instrument. It was a bit of an awakening, and now he's well into it. But it was just as inspiring as that. Awesome. Awesome stuff. Anyway, what more did my week contain? Yes. I was thinking about experiences at the shop because I listened to an episode of the podcast Diary of a CEO. Are you familiar with that one?
Yes, I'm very familiar with
Stephen Bartlett is the chap. But the most recent episode had James Hoffman on it, who is a coffee person, a weird coffee person he'd probably want to be described as, who I follow on YouTube. And, you know, he talks about coffee and how it's interesting. They did a little tasting of high street kind of stuff and it was fine. But there was a bit that reminded me of certain people in the shop asking certain questions and it being difficult. So in the podcast, I think this was in reference to the more recent book that James Hoffman released, which is something like How to Brew the Best Coffee at Home, something like that. So it's kind of a beginner's-ish guide, but there's good depth there for more intermediate and experienced coffee nerds. And Stephen remarked on the section, which is, you know, building your coffee station setup at home or whatever. And he did the old, okay, if I had 200 quid, what do I buy? Which is a stupidly open-ended question. And the only way to navigate that conversation is to ask more questions. You have to build the narrative around a customer. Stephen Bartlett is the customer here, to find out they might think they know what they want, but they actually don't. You need to find out what they need. You know, you're familiar with that story, aren't you?
Yes.
It happens all the time. People go, oh, I do such and such a musical thing. Actually, no, here we go. I do open mic nights, pub gigs, and I need wireless. That was a common customer that annoyed me because they don't. But you then have to take them on the journey, don't you? So tell me about the music you're playing. What's your setup at the moment? Why do you want wireless? Well, let me tell you about analog and digital wireless. And it's fun sometimes if the customer is interested and receptive and they go on the thing. But Stephen Bartlett did the other thing, which really annoys me, which... James Hoffman then goes, oh, well, it depends. What kind of coffee would you... And he goes, oh, yeah, just 200 quid. What do I need? He did that thing. You know, it was frustrating. Very annoying. There we are. Diary of a CEO. The episode with Stephen Fry was amazing. James Hoffman, not so much. I didn't like it. There we are.
I did see it come up in my YouTube stream.
Yeah, I forgot. It's fully video as well. I just listened to it on the old Spotify.
I have listened to selected episodes from that.
Gets good guests on, so it's definitely worth a look.
Mind you, gets a lot of the guests that a lot of the other podcasters get on as well. So
they do the tour.
Yes. They're normally promoting a book or something.
Yeah, most of the time.
It's a good way to get people on, isn't it? Come on and talk about your book.
We need to write a book then.
Or we need to get people on who write them.
Yeah.
We need to get people on who've written books.
Yeah. Don't know anybody.
Well, or made since.
Made a thing.
Made
yes.
a thing.
Do I know anybody who's
or
made a
thing? Or a module. Well, we had Finn on.
We did. That was a good episode, that one. Where do we start? We've got some software news this week. Firstly, a VC VRAC thing, which is a new module called Soundstage. Ooh, it is a paid one. This one costs $19 at the moment, but it is a system for creating a virtual room and placing your sound sources within it, which is super cool. So it's a physically accurate room reverb module, but the interface is kind of this 2.5D, I like to call it. So it's 2D, obviously, but it has a 3D representation. You can move your sound sources around. It will get wetter in reverb mix the further away it goes. It'll do panning as well as, I think, it will do a bit of frequency stuff in the vertical. But that is super cool. If you're big into your VC VRAC Soundstage, have a look. Of course, modulatable, because it is modular. Next on the software front, we have the equivalent, but slightly better, to MIDI monitor.
Okay.
Do you remember? We use MIDI monitor all the time in the shop. It was great.
Still do.
Yeah. Brilliant for diagnosing all sorts of weird stuff. But It only works on the Mac, as far as I know, and I never quite found a suitable Windows equivalent while I was there. There is one that is worth a look if you want good visibility on what your MIDI stuff is doing. It is called Show MIDI. Look it up. Show MIDI. Free, open source, and for diagnosing weird MIDI issues, that could be where you need to go if you're on Windows. Next one that is pretty cool is a new utility, I would say, from Soma Labs, makers of the Lyra, of course. It is called the Metaconformer. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't.
Could potentially be interested. So, USB-powered, sort of PCB sandwich type deal. Looks like that.
Okay.
You have, I think, two inputs, four outputs, 3.5mm MIDI, with switches to be type A or B, and it can do a bunch of things with that. So, you could do something like have a single master keyboard, four synths connected, and use the Metaconformer to run them as a four-part multi-timbral machine.
Okay.
So it will do kind of voice allocation through MIDI for you, which is neat. You can also use it to play them all as a giant ultra monosynth or something, just all big unison type stuff. And you can store presets for this and switch between them really quickly, because of course you could just do that by putting them on the same MIDI channel. But what interests me is you could use this to turn the Digitact into a four voice poly.
Okay.
Oh yes, you could. So, have you ever messed around with single cycle waveforms on the Digitact?
No.
So, there's a few on there, I think, from the factory. You just load it up into the sample slot and set the loop points so that, you know, it just, well, set looping on and it just plays like a sawtooth. And of course, you can play it chromatically, which is great.
I've seen it being demonstrated on some of the Synfluencers explanations when the Digitact first came out.
Yeah, it works quite well if you're just doing a mono single note part. You can sequence that quite easily. And it's cool. Obviously, you've got filters, drive, envelopes, do whatever you want. There is a Max for Live script, I think, that somebody made that lets you do this. If you set that kind of synth sound up on four channels, you could then use the Metaconformer to take your master keyboard's MIDI, split each note onto a separate MIDI channel, pipe it back all into the same place in the Digitact, and you could use it as a poly, which is super cool. And of course, you can do, you know, boring stuff like just switch between synthesizers or something. But it's a cool little utility. I'm sure there's way more interesting stuff that you can do with it, but I had a glance through the spec, realized that you could do the Digitact thing, and went, I don't have a Digitact, so why would I care? But it's cool. It's really cool, and I'm sure it can solve a lot of problems for a lot of people. That is the Metaconformer from Soma Labs. Price and availability, €160. It's an amount.
Yes, that's quite a chunky amount, actually.
Let's see.
For what it is.
See if there's any uber features that I've missed. Specs and manual. Aha. Okay, so the main two will be split and combine your master MIDI kind of thing, which kind of it does what it says on the tin. But the other thing is the translator, which allows you to affect sound parameters in your synth's sound engine using the keys instead of turning knobs. So it's kind of like key tracking on a filter, but for any parameter you want, because it'll just turn it into a CC.
I see.
Which is, oh, UCC? Anyway, that's pretty cool. Niche, but it could solve your problem.
Assuming you can identify the problem in the first place.
That's true. And MIDI is a potentially tedious place to be if you're trying to troubleshoot and problem solve.
Yes.
Two hardware releases. Firstly, the Torso Electronics S4, which is a four-track tape machine workflow-based sampler. I think there was one of the news sites that exclaimed in their headline, "The Digitact Killer?" No. No, it's not. That's not the idea. So, four stereo tracks, which operate in sort of a tape loopery type way, which then have, each of them will have creative processors on top. For example, a granular processor with time warping and pitch shifting features, quite a well-featured filtering suite. There's a resonator with a 48-band filter bank, and I think you've also got reverb delay, bit crushing, drive distortion, compression, all this kind of stuff. And I believe it streams samples over USB in addition to the roughly 4 GB of internal memory and such. Has two outputs, two inputs, MIDI stuff, quite flat aluminium enclosure. We need to wait for the old Synfluencers to get their hands on it, but it does seem like it could be quite interesting and a bit different in the sampling space. That's the Torso Electronics S4. They made the T1, that was their other product, which is a sequencer MIDI controller thing. Finally, in what has Behringer done now? At last, they have released the UBXA. At great expense, it's about 1600 squiddly boys, but it's there. It's big, it's poly aftertouch, it does stereo things.
Is it really that much money? I didn't think it was that much money at all. I thought it was close to $1,000.
$1,500, I think I saw it on Thomann at €1,600.
Oh, maybe it is up there.
It's big, yeah. And
who's going to spend that much money when they can get an OB6 for a
bit more?
A little bit more, especially if you buy a second-hand one.
But they won't have you to show them that they're thinking of the wrong idea. But there are demos around, so you can hear it now. But yeah, Poly Aftertouch is interesting. We'll see how the software holds up, because I'm sure it sounds all right, because a lot of the Behringer stuff sounds okay. But Dave from the ModCaf recalls that actually he met me in the shop, and we were talking about this before I said, hey, come down to the ModCaf, many moons ago, and it's been another one that's taken ages and ages to actually come to fruition.
Yeah, they seem to be really struggling. And things like DeepMinds currently,
yeah,
we have got no ETA.
Ooh, one of those.
We have a number of them ordered, and I think the date was, it's one of those holding dates, but I think it was saying April the 1st, 2025.
Wow.
And there's quite a few other Behringer products that don't seem to be available as well, if you go on.
Well, there's so many of those new ones, or these established ones that they still don't have ETAs for.
Yes, they're established, lots of established ones.
Mm.
So whether they've got a component issue, or maybe
quite
they're
possible
focusing production on some of these newer products, because they've most probably got a level of saturation with various things. I think the DeepMind's been out for 8 years, I want to say.
Wow, it's a good run.
Certainly that ballpark.
Alas, it's from a previous era of Behringer, though. It's that old.
Well, it doesn't matter. It's a good synth.
Yeah. What product is the kind of turning point? Because I think from memory, it's the Model D, the little module.
That was one of the first ones that
when they really went in for the knockoffs.
That was quite a few years later than the DeepMind.
I still think it's maybe 5 or even 6 years ago, though.
Possibly time is all compressed in a weird way, but yeah, 5 years.
I want to know now.
And then they brought out the SH-101 tribute.
Oh, yeah. And had the naming issue, and Roland got angry.
And that doesn't seem to be available anymore.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Try and find one, other than the second-hand one, obviously.
It's looking like it was potentially 2018, the Model D.
Well, that's 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, because before that, they would have had the range of kind of rubbish analog mixers. DeepMind was around. They might have recently eaten Midas, potentially. Actually, no, I think the Midas engineer kind of thing was around the same time as the DeepMind project.
Quite possibly.
Hmm. Anyway, speculation, reminiscence, or something. The UBXA is around. Look up some demos if you're interested. But as Pete rightly says, go grab an OB6 if that's your flavour. If you like your blue pinstripes, anyway.
Yes.
Finally, we must round off the evening. Well, it's evening for us. Don't know when you're listening. With our miscellaneous multimedia recommendation, I'm going to go first and tell you to look at tinyurl.com/rackaddicts for our After Hours playlist. And I've come dangerously close to adding some metal to it. In fact, I have, but there is still no screaming. It's family friendly. This is from the new EP by Spirit Box, Fear of Fear. The song is Ultraviolet, and it's got a massive chorus. You're welcome. Pete, what have you got for us this week?
Right, jumping back to the bicycle theme of earlier, a channel that I referenced to try and understand how to set up some Dralias,
yes,
which I failed miserably in the process of doing so, but thought was a rather good and informative channel, was this one, which appears on YouTube, and the channel title is GMBN Tech.
Aha, yes indeed.
And it seems to be festooned with lots of videos. Seems primarily mountain biking, but there were a lot of kind of workshop tutorials on various configurations and setups, and I thought it was quite useful. So basically, that's my multimedia recommendation for this week, the YouTube channel GMBN Tech.
Indeed. They are, in fact, a large network of channels. They have GCN, Global Cycling Network, Global Cycling Network, which is their sort of road bike focused one. GMBN, Global Mountain Bike Network. They have GTN, Global Triathlon Network. They have various other different language options for the channels, but some of the channels get it right and have had some pretty good sweet spots where they kind of had the Top Gear effect, where you stayed for the presenters and who cares about the subject matter, and they did stupid challenges and things. The golden era of GCN before it got a bit too commercial was with a guy called Matt Stevens, who I think then left to a different channel for Sigma Sport, but he's very charismatic and funny, and I think he does sort of interviews and stuff now. But there's a great presenter on GCN who does some off-road bits called Simon Richardson. And when their videos are really good, they're really good. And then some of them are in the same way that lots of synth channels are. They're kind of, you know, just, here's a product we were paid to tell you about. But a lot of the tutorial stuff, especially for new cyclists and, yeah, general maintenance, some really good stuff on there.
I thought so.
All kinds of cycling. There's a red channel for you. They're all quite red. Anyway, that brings to a close Rack Addicts After Hours episode 197. Blimey, that's a few. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you in the next one. Farewell!